This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. No doubt you've heard by now that the world's going to end this year. There are those who have interpreted the end of the ancient Maya long count calendar to mean doomsday. But they aren't the only ones making big predictions about the end of days. In fact, the end of time is a preoccupation in some religions. Perhaps you've heard of the Christian radio broadcaster Harold Camping. He predicted the end of the world not once, but twice in 2011, which of course caught the attention of Daily Show host Jon Stewart.
A California radio station's paid for hundreds of billboards to warn drivers, say on their way to work, that they have less than a month before the end of the world as we know it.
89-year-old radio host Harold Camping says the world is going to end next Saturday.
He's 89! Actuarially speaking, he's probably not that far off.
Well, there you go. And not to be outdone, science often theorizes about life-killing asteroids and the threat of nuclear disaster. And it seems as though you can't turn on the TV these days without running into a show about a zombie uprising. So on today's program, we're going to talk about apocalyptic thought and how it shapes the way we think about our world. Now, first, we want to focus on the Maya prophecy, and here to talk about that is Robert Sittler. He is director of Latin American Studies and a professor of modern languages at Stetson University in Florida. The Rhine Research Center is sponsoring a talk by him at the Stedman Auditorium on the Duke Center for Living campus at 7:30 tonight, but we have him here in our studio first. Robert Sittler, welcome.
Thank you. Good day.
Good to have you here. Also, we're taking your phone calls and emails, 877-962-9862. Do you have a theory about the end of the world, a question about how or when it might happen, or want to join the conversation about why we are so preoccupied with this? 877-962-9862, SOT@WUNC.org. Let's talk about the Mayan long count calendar, this one that seems to come to an end, December 21st, 2012. What is it?
Well, I think perhaps we should start by saying that the calendar, in fact, does not come to an end. That's very important to point out. Recently, Professor David Stewart at the University of Texas theorized that the long count actually extended to some 28 octillion years. So this particular cycle that we're talking about, this period of time that most people are focusing on, is about slightly more than 5,125 years in length. While that's a very significant period, in ancient Maya terms, it was merely a blip on the screen, so to speak. That calendar cycle, or that period of time, started in 3,114 BC on or very near to a solar zenith, and will be ending, depending on who you talk to, most people agree that it's on the 21st of December on the winter solstice of this year.
So what are these cycles? Why did the Maya mark that as a cycle, or is that something we picked up out of there?
That's a very good question, actually. There are many Maya scholars that do not see that period that I described as a cycle in and of itself. There are 13 smaller units within that cycle that the ancient Maya knew as peak. It's usually written P-I-K, and that was a period of 144,000 years. We do know that for sure that they would see December 21st as the end of that particular peak cycle. Whether they saw the 13 peaks as a cycle in itself, it for me, as a person who spends a lot of time in the Maya world, it's hard to imagine that they did not, because 13 is their sort of favorite number, if you will. The date back in 3,114 BC, the numerical sort of coefficient at the beginning was 13. It will be that exact same date again at the end of the year. So whether they saw that as a cycle is something perhaps we can't answer, but certainly they would have seen it as a significant date. And we do actually have one hieroglyphic reference specifically to this date that's coming up. So we knew at least that one person thought about it.
And what did they say about it in that reference?
Precious little, unfortunately. This is a text that, for those of you that want to look into it, it's a Monument 6 from Tortuguero in Mexico. And all it really tells us, it gives us the exact date. It's very explicit. We know that this is the date that they were thinking of. It's for Ahau on the 260-day calendar. All they tell us is that a particular deity, or it may even be a set of deities by the name of Bolon Yocte, will be present at that point in time. And academics have been quick to point out, first of all, that that's, in a sense, all we know about what the ancient Maya thought. But they may have been precipitous in saying that that doesn't mean anything at all. Bolognocte appears elsewhere in other Maya, not so much in the hieroglyphic text, but in later colonial period texts, also in the post-classic texts. And he appears there consistently as a god of warfare. A god of when there is great strife. And he appears at these changes, sort of the end of one cycle and the beginning of the other. So that's quite natural. To begin something new, things have to kind of fall apart. And so Bolognocte, not surprisingly, will supposedly be there once again on December 21st.
So that's all we know about what the Maya thought or said about this moment. But we also know that they had a sense that things might go on. There's a prediction.
Clearly. Although the Maya did not make lots of predictions. In spite of what you might read online, there is no set of Maya prophecies. We do, though, have another explicit future reference. I think there are only less than – I only know of two personally – to a date in the far distant future. I can't give it to you off the top of my head, but it's in the 4000s AD. So we do know for a fact that they assumed that the world would continue after this date coming up.
We also know that this is one – this long count calendar is one of at least three
– That's correct.
– calendars. So what was the function of this calendar and how does it – and tell us about the other two.
Yeah, I think it's easier to explain the long count by talking about the other two first. Perhaps I would argue the most important Maya calendar, because it's the only one that is still in use by contemporary Maya, is what modern Maya called the Cholquich, or what we typically call the Tzolk'in. This was a 260-day calendar that simply rotated. Once you got to the last day, you started over again, irrespective of any astronomy, irrespective of anything else. This is a very consistent 260-day calendar that they used for ritual purposes. They had a calendar very much like our own that was a 365-day calendar. So this is what they would use primarily for agricultural purposes. They would know when to plant, etc. It did not, though, take into account the slight discrepancy. Of course, our actual year is a little bit longer than that. It did not take that into account. And the calendar drifted over long periods of time. Between those two calendars, however, the Maya and other Middle American peoples could only specify a date within approximately a 52-year period. So if they wanted to be more specific and make sure there was no confusion between dates, they would use this long count calendar to clarify.
It's interesting, though, that they had this calendar. Is it a more accurate agricultural calendar?
The long count?
The long count, yeah.
No, I would say the long count really has no relationship whatsoever to agriculture. It was simply a very accurate way of counting and accumulating days.
Well, but you say there's very little in the literature from the Maya about the future. They seemed not to be interested in the way that we are.
It didn't seem to be so much of a preoccupation for them as it obviously is for us now at this point. Again, we can only speculate upon that because there are so few references. And that I think that might be significant because we do have actually thousands of hieroglyphic texts available to us. And most of them, I would say, are historical in nature and refer to the leadership at that particular time, wars they fought and that sort of thing.
Any idea why you would go to the trouble of making such an accurate calendar that goes so far out into the octillions, as you say, without really being as preoccupied with the future as we are?
No. To be perfectly blunt, I really don't know. But it is, of course, these sorts of things are the things that have attracted researchers to the Maya world as soon as, you know, really from the beginnings of archaeology in our hemisphere. Why did they do that? Why did they spend so much time figuring out such complex mathematical systems? Why were they such, really, for their time, masters of astronomy? Some credit them with originating the concept of a zero. In many ways, for people that, you know, moderns would regard as very primitive people, they were extremely advanced in many ways. And we really don't know the answers. I think the astronomical underpinnings that at least I think are there may have something to do with it.
Well, and at the peak of their culture, I think this is – we're talking about somewhere around 900 AD, right, roughly?
Well, actually, they're just about in the fading phase at this point. The last long count date that we see, I think, is shortly after that. I want to say about 910 AD. So the peak was actually a little bit earlier than that. And there was really leading up to that, there was a gradual collapse of most of the Maya centers, at least in the lowlands. And, you know, it's not at all that the Maya disappeared, but clearly they abandoned some of these major city-states and moved further south down into the mountains of what is now Guatemala and southeastern Mexico, and then upwards into the northern parts of the Yucatan Peninsula.
They may have had populations, though, at their peak that far exceeded anything on the European continent.
That may be. Of course, populations in that time are very difficult to determine. There's lots of controversy around that. But there was probably, you would have to assume, a major sort of die-off of people. There have been, the Maya have experienced several apocalyptic periods, if you will, on their own.
Do they in any way show up in the calendars or the glyphs as kind of predictions? Or
they do not. Not to my knowledge, at least.
So what is it? We've got about 30 seconds in this segment. What is it people are saying when they point to the Maya calendar that's going to happen to us?
What do Maya people say?
What do we say?
We say every crazy thing you can think of. Unfortunately, we say everything from we're going to join an interstellar federation to there's going to be cataclysmic earth changes. You look out there. I could not give an adequate list of all the things that people say are going to happen. It's really quite extraordinary.
We will talk more about that. Take your phone calls at 877-962-9862 and take a look at how we've looked at the end times, the end of time and the end of our universe in popular culture when the State of Things returns on North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, and today, talking about apocalyptic thought and how it affects the way we think about the world. We've been talking about the Maya prophecy with Robert Sittler. He's director of Latin American Studies and a professor of modern languages at Stetson University in Florida. Joining us now is Brett Whalen. He's an associate professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Welcome, Brett.
Thanks for having me on the show.
And also with us in the studio, Jerry Canavan. He is a PhD candidate in literature at Duke. Jerry, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Taking your phone calls and emails, 877-962-9862. Looking at the end times from a cultural perspective, how we look at it, our obsession with it, how others through the ages have talked about it, thought about it, and what it meant to them. 877-962-9862. Brett, we've been talking about the ancient Maya prophecy, or the lack thereof. You have spent a lot of time researching apocalyptic thought in the Middle Ages. What were people talking about then? Let's start with the Middle Ages.
Yeah, I focus mostly on the 11th, 12th, 13th centuries, which is the kind of golden age of medieval Europe. And one big thing that happened then, for example, is the Crusades and the crusading movement, where you have these armies, Christian armies marching on Jerusalem, trying to liberate the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And so crusading is one example of a sort of a big media event of the Middle Ages. And people immediately, when you drag Jerusalem into it, you're thinking about Christ and the meaning of history and the Christian Bible. So the Crusades are very much something that got thought of in apocalyptic terms.
And, of course, that's all based on the messianic mission of Christianity, which comes out of a messianic tradition in Judaism.
That's right.
That is tied to not just the deliverance, but the end of time.
That's
right. This transformation of humankind and the kingdom of God comes to earth. Apocalypse really meaning revelation of the truth, right? So does it come out of that, strictly out of that tradition, that kind of Judeo-Christian tradition of Messiah and end times? Is that what they're looking at?
Maybe not strictly, but certainly I was struck listening to Robert speaking earlier that talking about the calculations of the Mayan calendar, that in the Christian tradition, it's very much the Bible is really the major template, and it provides you the numbers that you need, both in the Christian Old Testament and the Hebrew Scriptures and in the New Testament. You can do all sorts of number crunching to come up with all sorts of different apocalyptic timetables. Some other elements come into it. There's some Greek and Roman prophecies that get brought in. But I think the Bible and the biblical number crunching and the idea of the end times when Christ returns in final judgment is really driving the Christian apocalyptic scenarios in the Middle Ages. But you see it right up into the present here.
And were there ebbs and flows in the kinds of anxieties about the end times or a sense of imminence?
There's different points. I mean, a lot of there's always debate, right, with historians and academics. And there's a big debate about the year 1000, but I think a lot of scholars agree that maybe on either side of the year 1000, which is a big, nice round number, also it's 1,000 years from the time of Christ, that there might have been some apocalyptic fervor around the time of the Crusades. 1260 was another point where people did some number crunching from the Book of Revelation and thought the world was going to end in 1260. So you do see these ebbs and flows.
And in that case, it's not necessarily an anxiety about social tensions or political tensions. It's this, we got this number 1260 by doing some ciphering and reading of the text.
People do the number crunching, but typically it is in response to political and social things that are going on, something like the Crusades, wars, famines, some of the usual suspects. There's also a lot of fighting in the Middle Ages, sort of ongoing struggle between popes and emperors over who's the kind of head honcho of the Christian society they're living in. And that sort of political fighting, again, helps kind of trigger some of these apocalyptic moments.
So, Jerry, we see how it plays out on the ground, at least in the Middle Ages. What about in literature? Are Christian themes important? What are the themes of end times in literature, in Western literature?
Oh, I mean, there's almost nothing more important than the Christian tradition. So I typically work on science fiction, where the model of the apocalypse has been kind of borrowed typically from the kind of Christian model and transferred into this kind of science fictional context and imagining different ways that the world might end and the kinds of horrors that would happen that were to happen.
What's the overlay? How do the themes change, or do they, against the social and political tensions of the time in which these books are written?
Well, typically, I mean, my argument is mostly about the sense of what it means to be modern. So in the modern period, we have this sense that we can do anything. We could build a paradise on Earth using science and technology. And then we realize, well, we could do anything. We could destroy everything. And so typically, you're looking at different moments where people are imagining how this could play out in different ways. In the beginning part of the 20th century, it mostly has to do with imagining that somebody will come and do to Europe what Europe did to the rest of the world, right? So imagining alien imperialists who come to colonize the Earth and blow up London the way London blew up so many other people. Today, it's often dominated by thoughts about the environment, right? What's going to happen when we run out of resources, or when we change the climate, or we have too many people, things like that.
877-962-9862 is the number to call. Ray is on the line from Greenville. Hi, Ray.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I just had a comment and a quick question for your guests there. So, you know, it's pretty clear that we are all kind of, I guess, obsessed as a culture with this apocalyptic thought and everything. I just want to ask your guests, I mean, I know that the major world religions all have prophecies and theories and things like that on the end of the world. Now, you know, how far does this permeate? You know, how is it every culture? Does it seem to come up more in, you know, indigenous, you know, cultures or not? Just how, you know, and is there any common thread that ties between the various beliefs on the end of the world, and just and how far, I guess, does it go within the cultures of the world?
All right, thanks, Ray. So the tie that binds, and those things that are different among cultures in their imaginings.
I mean, thinking about the Christian tradition, I mean, it's one argument. You mentioned the fact that they're drawing on the Christian but also Hebrew scriptures. And I know one argument scholars make is that a lot of this emerges from even earlier Zoroastrian ideas. So this would be thinking about the area of modern-day Iraq and Iran, and that the idea that there's a battle between good and evil, and that will come at the end of time, an idea of final judgment, that these are part of a Zoroastrian tradition.
Jerry? In terms of literature, I suppose literature from other cultures too, you might find differences or similarities.
Oh, I mean, it's an incredibly old theme. I mean, in some sense, it just has to do with our own lives, right? Things seemed pretty good when we were children, and now everything's getting worse and worse, right? But, you know, the Vikings had their version, Hindus have their version, right? So there's all these different instances of the apocalypse. And in the current moment, where so much of it is built around science fiction, you know, all cultures kind of come up with their own idea of.
But this does seem to be an obsession that comes out of Western culture, or that's expressed more vividly, and it seems to me more often in Western culture. I mean, is that because that's all I'm paying attention to? I suppose that's part of the problem. But if you look around, I don't see much of it expressed. If I read, you know, literature from the continent of Africa, from various places, not many people are too obsessed with how it's all going to end for many of them.
Well,
the sense of end, you know,
I mean,
happen.
My response to that would be that in a lot of those places, they've already experienced the end of the world, right, with the invasion of Europeans. And so a lot of times they put their moment of the apocalypse in the past, right, in the moment where Europe came and destroyed everything that had been known in those places.
Robert?
I would just add, I'm in no position to talk about other world traditions, but in terms of the Maya world, I've been going down to that part of the world and interviewing elders and spiritual guides for a number of years now. And this 2012 business and the end of the world has become extremely important during that time. It's this meme of 2012 has been reintroduced into the Maya world. And there, when I first went down there, there are a few Maya groups that have traditions about the end of the world already pre-existing. And it goes back to what in a sense, what Jerry was saying, because they've experienced the end of the world through attacks by the Mexican army, through destruction of the rainforest, through attacks by the Guatemalan army. It's not that out of the realm of their experience in a way. When I first went down there, though, you never heard about 2012. I was just down there this year, and I don't know if I spoke to a Maya person that had not heard about 2012, and they were consistently tying it to the end of the world. And when I asked them the source, a good percentage of them made reference to the History Channel. So in religious cities, I think they call it the sort of the pizza effect, where these cultural artifacts have gone out in the form of the long count, and now is coming back to them in this highly modified form. But because it comes from their ancestors, they readily adopt it.
877-962-9862 is the number to call. Kurt's on the line from Bear Creek. Hello, Kurt.
Hey, how are y'all?
Good.
I'm thinking with global warming, we really don't need to look back at ancient prophecy. We can see it, the writing on the wall. I think that for us to feel secure in our environment would be very misappropriated.
Well, let's talk about that, this idea that the writing is on the wall. Thanks, Kurt. And it was never more vivid, perhaps, than in the post-World War II period when the specter of nuclear annihilation swept over the planet, or at least the Western world. And that's when it starts showing up in films, Jerry. Talk about the apocalyptic visions in post-World War II film.
Well, I mean, speaking about the bomb, the most famous one is Godzilla, right? So Godzilla is woken up by nuclear explosion and comes and lays waste to Japan. And there's all sorts of versions of this. And, you know, kind of going again back to the Christian idea, right? So the original meaning of apocalypse was the name of the book of Revelation, right? And so typically the fantasy of apocalypse is about a revelation, right? Seeing the truth and changing one's ways before it's too late. And so in the 50s and 60s, it was about, why do we have these bombs in the first place? Let's get rid of them. In our moment, it's typically about, we've really done a lot of damage to the planet, so let's fix everything before it's too late.
Yeah, I'm struck. One difference I'm struck between the Christian and sort of secular scenarios is the idea that you might be able to do something about the writing on the wall. You know, if we can pass some sort of carbon tax, or if there's a meteor hurtling towards Earth, a brave band of astronauts will go up and blow it up before it gets here. Maybe a cure for the zombie disease. But, you know, you opened your segment with Harold Camping, and I think Harold Camping and his followers were positively looking forward to the end of the world. If you believe you're part of the saved who are going to be on the right side of final judgment, you're not looking to the choice you have to make is which team you're on, but not about what to do about the writing on the wall.
Well, yeah, and I think a pretty good example of that, sort of how we can turn it all around, is the film Armageddon. And in this scene, the character played by Bruce Willis sacrifices himself to save the world.
We're out of here in T-minus 3 minutes.
Daddy?
Hi, Gracie. Hi, honey.
Grace, I know I promised you I was coming home.
But I don't understand.
Looks like I'm gonna have to break that promise.
I lied to you too. When I told you that I didn't want to be like you. Because I am like you. And everything good that I have inside of me, I have from you. And I love you so much, Daddy. And I'm so proud of you. I'm so scared. I'm so scared.
I know it, baby. But there won't be anything to be scared of soon.
There you go. Pretty comforting. We messed up. We'll fix it. And it only takes one guy, which is kind of nice.
With a nuclear bomb.
Yeah, he can do it. It seems to me, how over time, or particularly, say, since 1948, Jerry, does this theme, again, change from one of kind of optimism, we're faced with the specter of annihilation, but a few good minds will bring themselves to this problem and fix it, and others that when does it turn dark? And it's like, well, we've gone past the point of no return.
Well, I mean, those things are always kind of in conflict. So, you know, 45, the moment of the bomb itself, there's a sense of suspicion of science, right? Even though science has won the war, it's brought this other kind of horrible thing into the world. And then Rachel Carson writes Silent Spring, and she says, well, it's not just the bomb. It's actually all these things that science have made are actually poisoning us and poisoning children who aren't even born yet. And so there's this kind of transition from a sense that science is making the world better to that science is kind of destroying everything. And that's become more and more dominant, I think, to the point in our moment where we're just incredibly suspicious of basically everything.
And that's a real turning point. If you think about an ancient culture like the Maya, you can go for centuries and millennia with roughly the same cosmic plan in mind. But that was a turning point where humans began to doubt their own psyche. The way they think and perceive became the enemy. Well, that's pretty darn scary, and it's hard to develop a cosmology around that. 877-962-9862 is the number to call. And let's go to the phones now. Chris is on the line at Fort Bragg. Hi, Chris.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I want to ask, you know, I want to ask your guests, I think they might be familiar with this, this idea of a technological singularity that, you know, I just recently heard about it the other day, and it was pretty interesting, and, if they're familiar, can you talk about it for a minute?
Well, let's do that. And that's the notion that basically, thank you very much for your call, Chris, that you can sort of upload all of our intelligence to the cloud, and there will be. We will all reside in one place with one singular mindset, end of war, end of history. We just go and download what we need. It's all there. Has this been reflected in film and literature very much?
Well, this is one of the most popular versions of a kind of optimistic future that we have right now, the idea that science is going to kind of leap forward, we'll all live forever, we'll no longer have these kind of material worries, we can not worry about the environment because we can just go inside the computer and live in there. And then it also has its kind of bad version where if we built all these computers and robots that are smart, what do they need us for, right? And that turns into Terminator or The Matrix and things like that, where the machines kind of take us over and we lose some sense of what it means to be an authentic human being.
In the Middle Ages, Brett, was technology much of a concern? Certainly things were changing. We're getting, you know, printing presses and better warfare techniques. But was that much of sort of on the minds of people?
I wouldn't necessarily think of technology as being at the center of apocalyptic ideas. But what I find fascinating about this is a lot of times when we're thinking about apocalyptic scenarios in the Christian tradition, there's an emphasis on Antichrist and all the tribulations and the trials and all the bad things that are going to happen. But in fact, an equally important part of the apocalyptic tradition in the Middle Ages, and I think up to the, maybe this is a little bit lost in the present, I'm not sure, is that it can also be a period of possible renewal and redemption, perhaps the creation of a millennial kingdom of peace and prosperity here on Earth. So this idea that there might be this great sort of transformative moment that will make everything better before the end is in there too, in fact.
Well, the other name for the technological singularity kind of famously is the rapture of the nerds. Right.
Nice.
But it also, there's this sense then that we give up a certain autonomy if we give ourselves over to singularity. And that's a bit of a fear and maybe reflected in movies like Zombieland.
Planet Earth, home to over 6 billion people. Today, our very existence is threatened by epidemics, climate change, and dwindling resources. But those are the least of our problems. Welcome to Zombieland.
My mother always told me, someday you'll be good at something. I mean, I don't think she could have guessed that something would be zombie killing.
What do you think? Zombie kill of the week.
So, what does the rise of the zombie tell us about where we are as a culture and what we're thinking about, Jerry?
Well, you know, thinking if we were worried, you know, in the 70s and 80s about the environment and a world that's going to die, the 90s are really about a world that's already dead, right? You've already run out of everything, and it's just now about scrabbling with each other to get what little is left. And so, you know, the kind of famous story of the zombie is that your neighbors are outside waiting to kill you, so you have to kill them first, and it becomes this kind of complete breakdown of everybody killing everybody.
And, of course, the great film that's seen over and over again in sort of for the body snatchers, right, the invasion of the body snatchers, this idea that you struggle against the takeover, but once you're taken over, you don't realize it and you succumb and you're part of the problem. Susan Sontag wrote a wonderful essay, and it was decades ago, and she says, look, the dark secret behind human nature used to be the upsurge of the animal, as in King Kong. The threat to man was the availability to dehumanize lay in his own animality. Now the danger is understood as residing in man's ability to be turned into a machine. That seems is that how our fear, do you think, has really changed over time? It's less what's coming from the outside and more about the fact that transformation could happen from within. We become complicit in this awful machine ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of weird thing about body snatchers is that in some way they're better at being us than we are, right? They don't have to sleep. They don't mind working. They're completely devoted to the jobs and do all the things they're supposed to do. They don't have any of the kind of screwed up excesses that normal people have, right? And so they're kind of a perfected version of us, and that's what makes them so horrible.
They're very, very efficient, and those efficiencies have come to hurt us all. I want to thank all of you for being on the program today.
Thank you very much.
You got it.
On the show today, Jerry Canavan, PhD candidate in literature at Duke University, Brett Whalen, associate professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and Robert Sittler is director of Latin American studies and a professor of modern languages at Stetson University in Florida. He's going to speak tonight at Stedman Auditorium on the Duke Center for Living campus at 7:30. For more information, you can go to rhine.org. Up ahead, the music of John Shane. Stay tuned.